This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee.
Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk presented by Basic Tipton right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, hosting the show live from Big Sandy, Belmont Park, as we get you set for American Pharoah's run at Triple Crown History this Saturday right here on HRRN. Want to extend a special welcome to everyone joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220 XM Channel 206 and everyone tuning in worldwide with our live streaming on your computer, on your smartphone, or on your tablet. It's all there for you at horseracingradio.net. Tonight's guest, well, he knows a thing or two about the Triple Crown, and that's because he's won it. How about that? He's one of only 10 trainers to have successfully guided a horse through all three legs of the Triple Crown. He is trainer Billy Turner, the 75-year-old native of Rochester, New York. And in 1977, he went on a very magical ride with the great Seattle Slough. And Billy joining me for the full hour on the program here tonight. Billy, welcome to the show. It's an absolute pleasure to be sitting here with you.
Well, it's an honor to be here because you're doing great things for the game.
Well, I appreciate that. You've done some amazing things as well. Can you believe it's been 38 years since Seattle Slough?
No, I really can't. I really, really can't. I thought that after Slough and Affirmed and the Secretariat, I thought that, it might be 10 years, but not 30.
Yeah. Yeah. How great is it to be able to tell people, yeah, I won the Triple Crown?
Well, really never say it that way. I just don't because, I had a phenomenal horse and he overcame everything and he still won the Triple Crown and all that kind of stuff. I just consider myself very lucky to have such a horse. And of course, people come up to me and say, well, when are you going to win another Triple Crown? And I said, well, if I can find a horse as good as Seattle Slough, I might do it.
What made Seattle Slough so special?
Well, he was a phenomenal talent. He was not only he had all the angles to be a running racehorse. He had but he had a brilliant mind. And he all he wanted to do was run. There wasn't, you never had a class problem with him in a race because he really knew that he was the dominant horse, and the other horses knew it too, and horses didn't want to run with him.
Yeah, yeah. When he pulled off the Triple Crown right here at Belmont Park, that afternoon was extremely emotional for you, wasn't it?
Well, what it really was a total relief because I had said after the champagne, I told a couple of friends, and I didn't know one of them was a reporter for the Daily News, but I just said, well, you know, if I can't win the Triple Crown with this horse, I haven't done my job. And he rode it. So the heat was intense from there.
That'll increase the pressure level just a little bit.
Oh, did it? You really did, because, I wasn't worried about winning the Derby, and I wasn't worried with winning the Preakness, but how in the world was I going to get this big, wild-running son of a gun to go a mile and a half into Belmont? That was a very, very serious thing with me, and when I put him in training at the beginning of his three-year-old year, we were down at stable at Hialeah, and we'd take him out there. We trained him on 1 hour every single day, He never got a day off because he couldn't. He had so much energy, you had to just control it. And I'm just thinking, how in the world am I going to get him around the Belmont mile and a half? Because I know we can do the others, but phew, the rest of it's going to be a problem.
How did you do it?
Well, we started out jogging him down at Hialeah, and they have a 3/8 mile chute. If you've never been to Hialeah, it was a wonderful old racetrack.
Yeah.
In fact, it was one of the premier racetracks of all time. And they had a 3/8 mile chute where they'd run two-year-olds in March, 3/8 mile straight away. And we'd go back into that chute, and we'd jog him left for 10 minutes and right for 10 minutes. And so that's 20 minutes of jogging. You've gone a long way. You've gone about 4 or 5 miles by then.
Sure.
And we'd do that, and then we'd take him out and go around the racetrack jogging. And then we got to the point where we'd start him galloping, and the last part of it, and we'd gallop him 3/8, half a mile, no more, and pull him up, because he was so big and strong then that if he ever ran off, that would blow his mind. He would be ruined.
Okay.
And so we worked it out and increased it a little bit, and finally got him so we could gallop him 1 1/8 miles and all that kind of stuff. And then the rest was history. We raised him twice in 5 months, and ran him 7/8 mile at Hialeah, and he beat he ran against a horse that had the same record he does: 3 wins, three starts, 3 wins. A horse called White Rammer, and he was a fast horse, and they came out at the gate together and went down the backside a little ways, and then Slew just drew off and broke the track record.
Yeah.
That stood till they closed the racetrack.
I can remember there were times that you were actually criticized for maybe being even a little too patient with Seattle Slew.
Well, no horse in the history of the Triple Crown had ever been trained like that. But I knew the horse, and what we were trying to do is control his energy, because he fed off the crowds, and the more the crowds got around, the more he fed off it, and the stronger he got. It was just like one of those weightlifters, and all they when they're getting ready for a match, their muscles just keep building and building and building, and that's the way Slew did.
Yeah.
And he looked insignificant in the stall by himself, but when you brought him out there and put him in a competitive situation, all of a sudden he was massive. And, so we had to figure out how to control that. And wound up being the Belmont, wound up being his easiest race.
Yeah, I read a quote from Jean Cruguet, his regular rider, who had said that if it hadn't been for yourself and his exercise rider, Mike Kennedy, he would have been a nutcase.
Right.
So I think that, you know, has to mean something when you hear Jean talk about the work that you did with him and that Mike did. What was Mike's role?
Mike galloped him. Okay. Mike rode him all the time, and he was a steeplechase rider, and he came over from Ireland, and he started out riding for the Raymond Guest who brought him over here, and Raymond Guest he was our ambassador to Ireland at one point. And but he raced in this country, and he had like Tom Rolfe and Chieftain and some really good horses that he bred himself, and so he was big in racing, and plus he had steeplechasers, and so Mike came over to do about those, and then as soon as he got out from under his contract, he went out on his own, and he started galloping horses for, among others, Woody Stevens. And Woody had always had a lot of good horses. And then he would come over later on and get on one or two horses for me. And because I needed a good rider for certain horses. And the next thing you know, when I came up with a good horse like Slew, well, he stayed. Well, the rest is history.
Well, you had something in common right off the bat with the steeplechase beginnings, because that's where you started as well.
Right. And he had a very keen understanding of a horse. He was well schooled in Ireland before he came here. And he had a smart old trainer that he learned a lot from over there. And one really old school trainer. And then taught him some manners. You know?
Yeah. I had read that after the Triple Crown had finished, that you actually went back to the barn and into that empty stall and just began crying. And it was not so much out of sadness, but as you just mentioned earlier, out of relief.
It was total relief because I set the bar so high that I thought, oh my God. But then when it was over, it was just relief. The job was done.
Go back to the beginning. Talk about growing up around the steeplechase horses and how you kind of got interested in horses from the beginning.
Well, I started out, there was a fox hunt in Pennsylvania called the Cheshire Hounds, and it was considered the premier hunt in the country at the time. Well, I just happened to live in the community. My father worked for the DuPont Company in Wilmington, Delaware, and we happened to have a house out there in the country, and there was a barn across the street where he kept a couple of horses and all that kind of stuff. And I saw the fox hunt. So, well, we got a horse, and I went fox hunting. And I thought that was the greatest thing in the world. but I was just a little kid. And
how old were you?
I was 12.
Okay.
You know, that kind of thing. But I was working hard on my riding, there were a couple of people around that taught me a lot about riding and so forth. One of them happened to be a man called Dr. Jocus Jenny, who lived just down the street from us, and he had some young kids, let's say, well, 3, 4, and 7 or some simple thing like that. Well, Dr. Jocus Jenny was the man who originated bone surgery in horses in this country. He came over from Switzerland, and he went to work for the, well, he started teaching at Penn University in Philadelphia.
Okay.
And he was fascinated by, well, he was just a surgeon and doing research and so forth. And he would take me into the University of Pennsylvania on a Sunday, let's say. There's nobody there. And he would be doing experimental surgery on a dog, trying to put an artificial hip in a German Shepherd with hip dysplasia.
Mm-hmm.
And he pioneered in all that stuff. And he worked with the DuPont Company to develop various products, plastics, whatever that the body would accept, so that you could make artificial joints. And he did that all with dogs. And he wrote them up to the nth degree. Well, when he was doing some of these surgeries, I was his anesthesiologist on a weekend because, you know. But then he went on, and when Swaps broke a hind leg, at the end of his career or something like that, then they were desperately trying to save him for breeding. And so they called in Dr. Jenny. Well, he went in there and he put pins and screws and all this kind of stuff and put his leg back together, and Swaps made it.
Yeah.
And of course, anyway, he wound up being a good sire and all that kind of stuff. But that then all of a sudden, the whole idea of surgery in horses took off. And one of the last horses he worked on was Ruffian, and that kind of stuff.
Oh,
you know?
Wow.
But he was just a...
So he changed the game.
Oh, he changed. Oh, he was the game changer. And the University of Pennsylvania built the new Bolton Center for him. So they put all the newest ways of, because one of the biggest things, problems with surgery is after surgery, the horses hurt themselves getting up out of the, after the anesthesia and all that kind of stuff. And they put in all the modern things down at New Bolton Center, and they did it for Dr. Jenny.
Considering the influence that he had on you in those early years, did you ever consider going into veterinary work?
Oh, yeah. In fact, that was when I went to college in Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, and they had a very good dental school, they had a good law school, they had a good medical school. And they had a very good biology department and all those things. And I took all the undergraduate stuff and so forth. But when it came right down to going to vet school, I started thinking, well, this isn't for me, because I didn't like to see the animals injured. It really bothered me, and that's all they work for. They're working for the ones that are hurt.
Yeah.
And I don't like it.
You know? Depressing.
It was to me. I mean, the ones that do that, they just do it, and that's their job, and so forth and so on, and they do it very well. But it bothered me. I mean, really, really bothered me. You'd look in the horse's eye, and oh my God. You know, it was tough.
Talking with Billy Turner here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network, celebrating Triple Crown Week with the man who trained Seattle Slough to win the Triple Crown all those years ago. Hard to believe it's been that long. Billy, didn't you spend some time in those early days working with the great Burley Cox as well?
Well, of course, he was a family called the Lewis Ledyards moved from Long Island down to Pennsylvania. Lewis Ledyard was a top-notch lawyer, and he graduated with one of the best records that ever came out of Yale Law School or some simple thing like that. And he practiced some law in the city and so forth. And he had some heart trouble at one point. He was 6'7". And a wonderful man. Well, he decided he did get out of New York and go down to Pennsylvania. So they bought a farm down there, and they bred a few horses and so forth. Well, I was just a little kid. I'd help them get the hay in and fill the silo and all that kind of stuff. Well, it was farm work. I loved it. I mean, I was loved to have the opportunity to do it and so forth. Well, they had a 3-year-old colt that was out of a mare that had won the Maryland Hunt Cup, which is one of the toughest steeplechases in the world. And he wasn't that sound. So they thought, well, so they just gave him to me. They had a big family argument over him. They gave him to me because I was just a little kid and I was riding pretty well, so, and the rest is history. That horse turned out to be a very good timber horse, and Burley Cox, well, he didn't see it, but his wife noticed the first race that the horse ran in. He ran a brilliant race and finished third, and it was the only reason he was third is I couldn't control the horse. He was just completely out of control. I weighed about 105 then, and they had to carry about 65. So I was making it up in weight and this, that, and the other thing. Well, I was completely out of control. So I was over a good friend of Burley's son and daughter were more or less my age, and so I was over there at the house, and he said to me, He said, you know, boy, if you needed any, if you should have a hand with that horse. So I said, sure, I'd love to have. So he took the horse over and trained him. And he just blew him away the next couple of starts and with me riding him.
Oh, wow.
But Burley rode him himself. And he only let me ride him in races. He never let me breeze him. He never let me gallop him. I couldn't do it. He was just too much horse.
What ultimately led you to decide to give up riding steeplechase races and then get into training thoroughbreds?
I knew that I had no future in it. I loved it and all that kind of stuff. And I was very good at schooling horses and getting them going well and all that kind of stuff. But I was too big, and I had to reduce too hard. And I knew that if I had to lose X number of pounds before I raced, I didn't ride as well. And okay. So I said, there's no future here. And at that point, Burley Cox was just taking off again and starting to get a very good stable of steeplechasers. I went from a small stable while I was there to a big stable, and it had two-year-olds, and Burley didn't want to hear about the two-year-olds, so they went to me and I'd fussed around with them and so forth, and they started coming up with one two-year-old after another that could run, So that was where it all took off.
It becomes addictive, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What do you remember about first getting started? Was it difficult?
Well, no, because because
you had all the good two-year-olds.
Well, no, the thing is, I just had his horse.
Yeah.
But the thing is, then the powers to be in those days, they looked around at the talent, and when somebody needed a trainer, they just said, well, this boy will do you. And I got very lucky. The James P. Mills, who became Hickory Tree,
mm-hmm.
they were just early in the business, and they said, they took me as their trainer, and at the same time, Jonathan Shepherd was at the was working for Burley, or he had the year before he'd been there, and he went to George Strawbridge, and then that whole thing took off. But they all came from the nucleus at Burley.
Wow.
And of course before us with Burley was Mikey Smithwick, who became what really was the greatest trainer of steeplechasers that the country's ever seen. He trained more different kinds of horses for more different kinds of people, and won every race known to man and that kind of stuff. But he was Burley's best student.
I've often heard Billy Turner described as being a true horseman. What does that mean?
Well, what a horseman can do is you're given a horse and you figure out what their capabilities are, and then what you think that their best effort would be, and you try to figure out a way to get it out of them, and that takes some ingenuity, and it takes a lot of doing. And we had a lot of success doing it that way.
He certainly did. I read somewhere that you would spend more time talking with your horses than with your owners sometimes.
Well, the thing about it is, you know, you like the horses, and the thing is, they don't talk back. But that they will get upset with you, but they don't talk back. No, the owners, they don't understand, because they're not looking at the horses every day. An owner that's there a lot, it's a lot easier to train for them. But I had mostly absentee owners, and you're trying to explain what happened on the telephone. Well, they think you've given them a story, and you haven't.
Yeah.
You know? But you wish you had.
What do you tell young people that are just looking to get involved in this profession?
That's an open question. Never forget one of the owner that brought me to New York was a man called Milton Ritzenberg from Virginia, and he had a nice stable of horses. He maintained a stable here about six or seven horses, and he had an old trainer, Jake Byer, who was a good old time horseman. And he'd trained for him for a number of years. Well, he got old, and then he got a couple of trainers after that. And I was riding steeplechasers for him for Burley. And then when it looked like I wasn't doing that anymore, well, then he asked me to come and train his horses in New York. And, one right after the other started running as two-year-olds. And So it worked out well for everybody.
Hall of Famer Bob Baffert is going to be on the flip side of that. He's not looking to get into the game. He's well established and looking for the Triple Crown. He's been here three other times to try to get it done. It hasn't happened. What advice would you give to somebody like Bob Baffert, who's here in this position looking for the Triple Crown?
Nothing. Because I think he's done a very, very good job. And It's tough to say that you didn't win, but he came awfully close and several times, and so you don't want to change too much. The only thing I questioned was why didn't he come straight from Pimlico to here? But then I got to thinking about it. Well, shucks, he tried it a few times and it failed, so why don't you do it another way around? And that makes sense.
Yeah, well, he told me when he first came here with Silver Charm back in 1997, he went back and looked at old charts with Triple Crown winners to see how horses like Secretariat and Seattle Slew and Affirmed, and even going further back, how those Triple Crown winners were trained coming up to the Belmont. And he tried to learn from looking back on history. Did you do any of that with Seattle Slew?
Well, the thing is, when I started training in the first place, I'd already been studying the trainers of the good horses around me from the time when I was still riding jumpers. I wasn't interested in that. I was interested, and I wasn't worried about the guys that are running the claiming horses that are just trying to win a race tomorrow. I was trying to figure out how people like Henry Clark and down in Maryland there were a bunch of good horsemen down there at the time. And then you come up here to New York and you've got Tommy Kelly, and you got Woody. You always had to have Woody. And of course, I fast became very good friends with Alan Jerkins. But in Maryland, couldn't become friends with him, but I studied him like a book, and that was Frank Whiteley.
Sure.
And he wouldn't tell you anything and this, that, and the other thing. But after a while, he sort of got to like me a little bit. But he was a super good horseman.
Yeah.
And, that's where Shug got his start, and Barkley Tagg. He doesn't claim Tagg,
I'm talking with Billy Turner here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. We're going to get to a short break. We'll come back the second half of the program and continue this enjoyable visit here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Celebrating 10 years of Eclipse award-winning coverage. Thank you for making HRRN your home for a decade of memories.
Attention, calling all racehorses. Nominations are now open for the 2015 Basic Tipton Selected Summer Horses of Racing Age Sale to be held immediately following the July Selected Yearling Sale on July 9th in Lexington, Kentucky. It's the hottest sale of the summer, boasting a $77,000 average and a sale topper of $1,075,000 in 2014. The sale attracts major buyers who are there for one purpose, to buy. 128 horses were offered at last year's sale, a whopping 109 horses sold to 78 unique buyers, with 20 horses topping the $100,000 mark. Go online to nominate your horse today at HORANominations2015.com. That's HORANominations2015.com. The Fasig Tipton Selected Summer Horses of Racing Age Sale and the July Selected Yearling Sale. July 9th at the Fasig Tipton Sale Pavilion on Newtown Pike in Lexington, Kentucky. On Sunday, June 14th, watch and wager on the Woodbine Oaks presented by Budweiser. This year will mark the 59th running of the race at Woodbine, and Woodbine will guarantee both early and late pick four pools at $100,000 each and be offering 20-cent bet minimums on all Triactor, Superfecta, Pick 3, and Pick 4 pools that afternoon. Watch and wager on the Woodbine Oaks presented by Budweiser live from Woodbine Racetrack on Sunday, June 14th, post time 1 p.m. For more information, visit WoodbineRacetrack.com.
And they're off to New York, the premier state bred program in the United States. When you own a New York bred, your horse can run for more than $44 million in purses restricted to registered New York breds. And the New York program pays awards to breeders, owners, and stallion owners when their New York breds finish first, second, or third at New York tracks. We have the quality.
Day at the spa, all the way.
You have the opportunity. New York breds, get with the program. The best program.
Since 2006, the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund has provided critical financial assistance to some 60 riders who have sustained catastrophic on-track injuries. The lives of these former athletes who have given so much to the sport of horse racing have been changed forever. I'm Mike Penna, president of the Horse Racing Radio Network and proud supporter of the PDJF, and I ask you to join me in supporting this outstanding organization right now by texting the word jockey to 50555. You'll be credited with a $10 donation that can literally change the lives of those disabled riders who need it so much. It's quick, it's easy, and it's only $10. Who would think a simple $5 Exacta box would mean so much to so many? So let's all help make a huge difference in the lives of those riders who have given us so many great memories. Text the word jockey to 50555 today and visit pdjf.org to learn more. Message and data rates may apply. Terms mgive.org/chi. Hi, this is Mike Penna. Join me and our entire Horse Racing Radio Network team as we broadcast live from Belmont Park beginning Wednesday, June 3rd with three consecutive Triple Crown Countdown shows from 8 to 10 a.m. Eastern. We'll bring you all the latest information and updates on the 147th Belmont Stakes and get you ready for American Pharoah's Run at Triple Crown history. So join us for three Triple Crown Countdown shows Wednesday, June 3rd through Friday, June 5th from 8 to 10 a.m. Eastern and see a complete Belmont Week schedule at horseracingradio.net.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
They're coming on the turn with Seattle Slough still the leader. Seattle Slough, 1 mile and 138 and 4/5 now leads by a half. Still on the outside now, San Edmund has taken over. Then it's Run Dusty Run, swinging to the extreme outside, Iron Constitution. In the stretch, here he comes and he's opening it up again. It's Seattle Slough and he's drawing clear of the field. Seattle Slough has four lengths on Run Dusty Run. It's Run Dusty Run in second and San Edmund third. They're nearing the finish line. It's still Seattle Slough, and he's opened it out to 4.5. Then Run Dusty Run and San Edmund.
And the great Seattle Slough pulling off the Triple Crown back in 1977. Of course, Sean Cruguet aboard for the winning ride that afternoon, as he was. They had a great relationship, and it's nice to see them be able to reach that pinnacle together. It was all because of trainer Billy Turner, and he is with us now on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Really enjoyable visit in the first half of the program, and Billy hearing that race call and hearing Seattle Slough get the victory that day and do it so easily has to bring back just a flood of memories for you.
Oh, it does. And, well, the satisfaction of getting him to go 1.5 miles when you've got the fastest horse in the country, going short, and to get him to go a mile and a half, that was the biggest concern I had, and well, we got it done.
Let me read some of these names to you, and I know you're very much aware of this, but Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons, Ben Jones, Max Hirsch, Lucien Lauren, Laz Barrera, Billy Turner Jr. It's a nice list, isn't it?
Certainly is. I was lucky enough to be around when Mr. Fitz was still training. He was training for the Fitzes, and the used to be that at Saratoga, the jumping race would be the third race. And the fourth race was usually a two-year-old race, and Mr. Fitz would have a horse in the race just because he had a lot of them. What he would do is, because he was stabled at the far end of Oklahoma, he would come after the race, he'd wash his horse in the far corner of the paddock area at Saratoga, and then walk him home. By the time they got home, he'd be just about cooled out, which made good sense. But the old man would be sitting there on the bench. So I'd come out of the jock's room, go over there, and I'd sit down on the bench. Then I'd quietly ask the old man a question. And I was lucky enough to ask him the right question a few times. And when you do that, all of a sudden he'd light up, and boom, 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 boom. His mind was like a steel trap, and he'd give you information it was just a pleasure to listen to.
Yeah.
So I was lucky, because he looked like a decrepit old man, but he wasn't. His mind was really sharp.
Yeah, I believe it. You had the opportunity to make the trip to Versailles, Kentucky, to Three Chimneys Farm after Seattle Slough was retired, and you had the chance to go down and visit with him for a while, I know on a couple of different occasions. Tell me about that.
Well, one of the most memorable one was I hadn't been there in 10 years, and went into the rotunda area where, because the horse stallion stalls are sort of spread out around the outside, and there's a walking area in the middle and whatever. And I'm talking to the farm manager there and or the stable manager, and the old Slough, he came from the back of his stall up to the front, and he gave a low nicker. And it surprised everybody. They'd never, ever seen him show any affection to a human being ever, like that. And that really, really moved me, because shows that, because I was never lovey-dovey with him. I just trained him and left him alone, because he really didn't. He wasn't a lovey-dovey kind of horse. He liked people, but he was the boss horse, and they stand a little bit aloof, and you just let them be that way.
And you can tell.
Oh, yeah.
By their mannerisms.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He was the boss horse. he was the kind that if he was out in the range, he would be controlling the herd, and anybody that came around that didn't belong there, he'd kill them.
Wow.
You know, that's the kind he was, but he wasn't mean. He wasn't mean at all, but that's the kind of horse he would have been.
Earlier in the program, we talked about how there was a time when you had Seattle Slough that sometimes you were criticized for being too patient with him, and that is what eventually cost you Seattle Slough. He was taken away from you after the Triple Crown, and that, I can only imagine how difficult that must have been on you at that time.
Well, the reason that broke the whole thing up was Marge Everett put on a race out there in Hollywood that was brand new, and it was just for Slough. It was to get Slough out there and so forth and so on, and she put up a bigger purse than any of the Triple Crown races and all that kind of stuff. I wasn't prepared for that, and so I was adamantly against that move, because it just wasn't done. And after the Triple Crown, you give your horse a little bit of break. And I told the world, well, we'll probably run him back in the Traverse next, which is a ways away, and all that kind of stuff. And what? Because I couldn't relate. The horse was sound. He had nothing physically wrong with him. But what I couldn't relate to the people was he was mentally tired. And because he fed off the crowds, and he and the bigger the crowds, the more he was aware of everything. And that's what made him so devastating in the afternoon. You take that away from him, and he's just a horse. And I couldn't explain that. And it I could now, but I couldn't then. Yeah. And so they didn't understand, and they made a bad move.
Yeah. Was it hard?
What?
Was it hard on you?
No, because I knew once they made their first move that I'd lost control of the horse, because they never, ever questioned me about anything up to that point, ever. And when you've lost that, then you've lost, when you've actually had pulled off perfection. Nobody likes a perfectionist, but I pulled off absolute perfection. And then the whole thing starts to break down. And so that's why it fell apart.
Seattle Slew, of course, passed away on May 7th, 2002. It was exactly 25 years to the day that he had won the Kentucky Derby. What do you remember about the day you got that phone call?
Well, to be honest with you, I was relieved, because he'd had some serious neurological problems because of old age. He was just starting to sink, just like his back was starting to sink, and it just age. And I felt relieved. The horse is he's where he should be.
Yeah. You've been through an awful lot, by the way, talking with Billy Turner here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. You've been through an awful lot, both professionally and personally, since Seattle Slew. Talk about these years since Slew and what's been going on in your life.
Well, I've had, the thing is, after in 1990, they hauled me out of here in a bucket and put me in a rehab and got the and I got sober. And after I got sober, I was fortunate enough to come up with some of the best horses I've ever trained.
Yeah, and read where you'd said that once you did get sober, that the people that had kind of shied away from you when you were drinking had all of a sudden come flocking back, and that had to be a wonderful feeling.
Oh yeah, the people that put me in the game, they were all right there, and so forth and so on, and I was lucky enough to come up with a good horse for all of them. So
yeah, when you were drinking and going through those personal issues, I know that there was a time that you lost most of your business from
right.
going through that.
Right.
Again, a great life lesson, I would imagine.
Yes, but that's the history of alcoholism. And if you're lucky enough, when they took me out of here, I was darn near dead. In fact, they thought that I died before they got me to the rehab and all that kind of stuff. And
wow.
And that's where I had to be before it meant anything to me. Because I was, my friends that I was drinking with, they all had a problem. They were drunks, but I was fine.
Yeah. Of course. Well, congratulations on that. Being able to overcome that, it's not an easy thing by any stretch of the imagination. And I would imagine that now you get to look at things in a little different light. Is that true?
Yes, it is. It is. It really is. You.
What's the biggest difference?
You become more flexible. You know, you sort of get locked in when you're drinking. You have a direction, and you only go in that direction because you feel safe in it. And but then you become, when you get beyond that, you become more flexible, and and you like people again. You don't like people when you're really drinking.
Yeah.
You know, they're just in the way.
How about the horses?
Horses were not so. Horses, you feel safe with them because they're not going to criticize you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. They don't talk back, as you said in the first half
exactly.
of the program.
they might not be happy with you. You can see that sometimes, but they don't talk back.
So what still motivates Billy Turner and makes you get up and come to the barn every morning?
It's what I do, and I've always done it, and the biggest fear I have in life is not having horses to get up and go and do about in a given day.
What do you enjoy most about being a horse trainer?
Developing young horses and watching them flourish and go on to be and go on to perform. It's great
to watch. Yeah.
And some of them you just don't know how good they're going to be. And you take a horse like Slough. He was one of those that was so imposing that you without ever seeing him breeze or doing any, just being around him, you knew he was different from the rest. And whenever you're dealing with good horses, you want the one that's different from the rest, because that's the one that'll beat the rest.
You talked about the early days with Seattle Slough and what you were doing with him when you first got him, but when did you first realize, hey, this horse is special and he's different?
The very first time we breezed him right here at Belmont, I had an exercise rider, Tommy Pascuma, and the Pascuma family was famous in racing around here. In fact, his son Roy is the starter on the gate here.
Okay.
Today, and he's one of the best starters they've ever had. But Tommy was on him, and good rider, very good rider. And I told him, and I sent a 4-year-old mare out there that we were not four-year-old filly that we were legging up, and she was but she was a good racehorse, and you could do anything with her. And I sent her out there to be company for a Slough, and because I wanted an experienced horse that he could control, and so he wouldn't. Because I had a feeling that if he ever got the got running, he would really take off if he got in a competitive situation. So I was prepared for that, because he wasn't tight enough and anything. He could break himself down right in the very first breeze.
Wow.
So I told Tommy, I said, I'm going to send a mare along with you when you pass the quarter pole. Just let them breeze together through the stretch. And I said, if he should all of a sudden kick it in and get down a run, just start pulling him up right away. And it's a good thing I did, because he went along with her for a little bit, and they're going along very nicely. Then all of a sudden he looked over and he saw he had competition, and he was gone like that. And and Tommy pulled her up. They pulled him up. Well, he didn't get him pulled up till he was all the way halfway down the backside on the training track at Belmont. But then we didn't breeze him again till Saratoga, because in his second breeze he could have won any maiden race they had here going 5/8 of a mile. I mean, he was, because we had a bottom under him.
Yeah.
So he couldn't hurt himself. And But we didn't do anything until we thought we'd run him at Saratoga, and then he banged up a hock raising hell in the stall, and so we couldn't start him at Saratoga. We started him down here and ran him 3 times in 21 days, and he was a champion.
How about his jockey, Jean Cruguet? Where did that relationship start?
That was interesting. Eddie Maple had been riding for me a lot of horses, and And the year before, he rode Lord Henry B for me, who was the second best 2-year-old in the country behind Honest Pleasure. And he won 4 in a row, the Rockaway he won the last 2-year-old stakes in New York,
yeah.
and all that kind of stuff. And so he was going to ride, and so I naturally thought, well, shucks, he'll be the guy to ride Slew. And so we're up at Saratoga, it was time to put a key work into Slew. So I had Eddie over there. He was going to come over and get on him and so forth. And then his agent came and said that he had to breeze right after the break for Silveach, who had at that time one of the best 2-year-olds in the country. That he was, and Eddie won a couple races on him, and he was going to breeze him. And so I said, fine. Gene's standing there. I said, Gene, get on this horse, and we'll take him over there, and we'll breeze him 3/4 of a mile. Or no, we'll breeze him 5/8, and let him gallop out the 3/4 and all that kind of stuff. And I said, Gene, go along with him quietly, because this horse can really run. And I dropped him off with a pony, and then went back the wrong way on the train on the main track of Saratoga. And then I noted, and he was going along very nicely, and I had Jimmy Daly, who was the outrider. At the time, I'd alerted him that he was aware of Slew. He was very aware of him, and I'd alerted him that we might have trouble catching this horse. So if you could catch him, and so forth and so forth, and so when as he came out of the turn and the stretch, I says, Gene didn't think he was going anywhere, and I saw him turn a stick on him. And I ran out at the 8th pole, and I raised my hand up, and I said, Gene, pull him up. I just said, just pull him up. And so he started pulling him up. Well, he wound up going out 3/4 mile on 10. And
wow.
He
ran out onto the track.
No, I was on the pony.
Oh, okay. I was
on the pony.
Gotcha, okay.
And I just said, Gene, just pull him up. And then, so he pulled him up, and Jimmy Daly caught him on the lower turn. And, the thing is, at that time, they weren't running in 10 up at Saratoga. The track record was 10-1 or something like that. And here he's a 2-year-old, and he hasn't even started. Then the hoopla started because Gene, so the clockers are down there. Who was that? Who was that? And Gene says, shave, 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 shave. And I said, oh, Seattle Sioux. Yeah, fine. Yeah, that's right. And so it came out in the paper, Seattle Sioux.
Oh, jeez.
And and that was that. So we just and then so then the hoopla started. Oh my God, because they had the wrong name on the work and all that kind of stuff, and it just got better.
Talking with Billy Turner here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Billy, I was told that I needed to ask you about another horse, not Seattle Slew, but the horse's name is I'm For More.
Oh my God. I learned an awful lot from him. He'd been barred at Monmouth. He set the track record for 5/8 of a mile or 5.5 furlongs at mile as a 2-year-old. And I don't know, he ran in 2 and something. I don't know what it was, but anyway. But he started bolting when he came out of the gate and things like that, and he was barred, which means when you're barred, you're finished. and usually you don't ever get them back. Well, steeplechase trainer Charlie Cushman knew the people involved, and he got the horse to train here in New York, and he knew what he was getting, and he knew he was going to get me to get on him. And here I was just an amateur rider in those days, and amateur steeplechase rider, and this, sure, that, and the other thing. And so I started getting on him, and he was tough. He was really tough, and he was mean. He'd killed a groom in Monmouth. He'd see somebody coming, he'd prick his ears, and he'd be so glad to hear. And as soon as you got within range, he'd grab you right in the stomach.
Oh, wow.
And then he just, well, the way he killed his groom is he just took him in the stall and beat him off the walls, just like a rag doll.
Wow.
He was a real killer. And that was fine. And I got on him, and I rode him with long but dull spurs that wouldn't leave a mark and that kind of stuff. And I finally got him so that he would come out of the gate, and he would go straight, and he would do this and do that. But when I would get back to he had a groom that could handle him, a very good groom. But as soon as I got off him, I got away from him, because he'd come after me, just with a vengeance. If he could gotten loose, he killed me in a minute.
Wow.
Oh yeah. Oh, he was the real thing. The only real killer I ever saw. Well, the very first time he ran here at Belmont, he beat Rainy Lake and Green Ticket and those horses. They were the fastest horses in New York at the time.
Yeah.
And he was something else. And we worked with the starters, and the starters they were good in those days, but not as good as these guys now, but these guys are the best I've ever seen.
Yeah.
But I'm from Moore. He was a piece of work.
That's a scary horse. Only a couple of minutes here, Billy. Believe it or not, this hour has absolutely flown by. I always like to end by asking trainers what other things they enjoy doing outside of horse racing. Obviously, this is your life. This is all you know. But there are other hobbies, I'm sure, that you have.
Well, I was lucky enough for a few years there when I was making a lot of money to travel the world a little bit. Went to South America, went to Peru and Machu Picchu and Cusco, and went to Brazil, and went to Chile, and went to Easter Island in the Pacific. And
after the Triple Crown,
yeah.
Did people know who you were? Did they recognize you?
There any place that had racing, they knew me. I could go down to Barbados. I went down to Barbados, and I'm standing there and watching the horses come out of the paddock. Hey, Bill, good to see you, Jed. What are you doing down here? And they're all riders that were ruled off in the States.
They found a new home in Barbados.
Listen, they have very good racing down there.
Yeah, they do.
That's very good racing. Have you been there?
I have not. I would love to go see the Sandy Lane Gold Cup one year, though.
Well, I was down there just about 3 years ago and stayed at Sandy Lane as their guest, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Billy Turner, my special guest here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Billy, it has been an absolute delight. I've thoroughly enjoyed the hour, and really do appreciate you spending some time here, and all the best moving forward, my friend.
Well, thank you very much. I'm just I'm glad that you brought out a few things, and some of them was the truth.
There were a couple of pieces in there that were true. Billy Turner, ladies and gentlemen, and of course the trainer of the great Seattle Slough. Will we have another Triple Crown winner this Saturday? Well, we'll have it for you right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. You can join us for that exclusive coverage. Visit our website, horseracingradio.net, for a complete broadcast schedule, and of course to join us for our shows all
week long. It's been a remarkable visit here tonight, and want to thank everybody for tuning in coast to coast and worldwide. For my producer, Lee Delapina, back in our Lexington studios, and for our special guest tonight, Billy Turner, I am Mike Penna, and we'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.